Oyez, 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 the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are Board of Trustees of the Bastrop Independent School District versus September M. Tungate as next friend of Zachariah Tungate from Bastrop County. State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company versus Ronald H. Travert, executor of the state of Mary E. Davidson from Tarrant County. And John Verber, individually and his next friend of Thomas Verber, Timothy Verber, and Joseph Verber versus Patricia M. Dorner and the Methodist Mission Home from Bexar County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and complete the arguments before noon. These arguments are being recorded by our clerk for the convenience of the court. If you wish to purchase a tape of the arguments, you may make application with our clerk. The court is now ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Bastrop ISD versus Tungate.
May it please the court, Mr. Eric Schultz will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Eric Schultz. I'm here representing the Bastrop School District. With me at council table is Mr. Paul Hunt, also representing the district. The case before this court once again involves the school district hair length rule. And once again, the hair length rule is challenged as constituting discrimination because of sex, because the hair length rule only applies to male students and not to female students. We've raised 3 points of error before this court, and briefly those 3 points are the following. First point is the state judiciary should not intervene in these types of hair length disputes. That's the lesson of the court in Barber versus Colorado Independent School District. The court said the judiciary is not to micromanage the schools of the state with these types of claims. Indeed, intervention is not appropriate.
If the legislature passed a statute saying that no school district shall make grooming rules that differentiate between males and females with regard to hair, would that be unconstitutional?
No, I believe the legislature could pass such a statute.
If they could do that, then we have to look and see if they have done that, do we not? Regardless of what the Constitution may mandate.
However, in this case, there's really no viable distinctions between the constitutional claim and the statutory claim in this case. They both are premised upon the same language that prohibits discrimination because of sex.
But we do have to look at this statute.
Yes, that's the...
So Barber is not dispositive?
In my view, Barber certainly governs this claim. The rationale, the holding of Barber, applies equally to the constitutional and the statutory claim. I think Justice Powers, in his dissenting opinion in the Court of Appeals, hit the nail on the head. He said, indeed, the Barber decision was founded upon important and fundamental decisions regarding judicial policy.
Have you found any cases across the country that deal with statutory as opposed to constitutional issues in this area?
The analogous federal statute is Title IX. It also talks about educational institutions may not discriminate because of sex in the programs and the benefits they provide. In my brief to this court, certainly I cite the case of Trent versus Parrish. It's a court decision in which they looked at the Title IX statutory provisions that are very similar to the statutory provisions under state law and said, no, this is not sex discrimination in this case. The Department of Education, which enforces Title IX, says, no, these are matters of local control for the school district. Even though we're charged with enforcing Title IX, no, we don't intervene in these kinds of hair length disputes.
It's a statewide statute, though, isn't it?
Yes, it's a statewide.
And does it specifically say that each school district can choose its own criteria for implementing the statute?
No, but it's a statewide statute that prohibits discrimination because of sex under various circumstances. And I might remind the court, the statute carries criminal penalties, not just civil penalties.
Are you arguing that it could be a different standard, say, in the Dallas ISD and Bastrop ISD, Austin ISD, and Eames
ISD? I'm saying that the courts shouldn't intervene just like they didn't intervene under Barber, that indeed this is a matter for local control, for the school board to decide. This court said...
Where do you get that out of the statute? It's a statewide statute that applies to everybody in the state, every governmental entity in the state of Texas. Where do you get out of it that each school district can choose to do what it wants to do?
Based on the same policy reasons that underlay the court's decision in Barber. Students at school, their rights are not coextensive with the rights of adults in other settings.
So your argument does not come from the statute?
No, my first argument certainly is the non-intervention argument. Just as the ERA provides the maximum constitutional protection, but nevertheless, the court didn't intervene in Barber under the ERA. How could this statute provide more than the maximum protection? It provides the same civil remedies against the same state actors as the constitutional provision. The statute should be interpreted in accord with the constitutional provision in this text. Not only are the rights...
There are a lot more words in this statute than there are in the ERA.
True.
Do those words mean nothing?
I think...
Words like benefit, unreasonable burden...
No.
There's no way that could provide a remedy or place a burden on the state that does not exist in the broad parameters of the ERA.
Although the ERA...
You've already said they could pass a statute that was specific to Hare, and you'd have to honor it.
Yes.
Now, is there nothing in these words that we need to look at that raises the question of whether or not... this puts some burden on a school district apart from the constitutional requirements?
No, because the hair length dispute, just as in Barber, doesn't rise to the level to implicate.
The legislature didn't exempt hair disputes, did it, in the statute?
No, the legislature did not.
So where do you conclude that the legislature has exempted in the anti-discrimination statute hair disputes? Where does that come from?
It comes from judicial policy reasons.
So judges ought to decide whether to enforce the statute or not? Is that your conclusion?
My conclusion, just like this court concluded in Barber less than 2 years ago, that there are certain matters in which the state judiciary is less competent to deal with than the parent, the teacher, the school board, the school administrator.
It may be our decision, but how do we tell that the legislature's decision?
Because the statute and the constitutional provision were passed within 3 weeks of each other at the time of the 62nd legislature. If you look at the amicus brief that was filed in this case, you'll find that indeed the decision, the rationale of the Court of Appeals that this has an independent pedigree from the constitutional provision that's based on the Civil Rights Act of 1964, that analysis simply fails as a matter of course. Indeed, these two statutes were passed, the constitutional provision was passed within 3 weeks of the statute. They both contain the same language prohibiting discrimination because of sex. Indeed, they should be read in harmony together. The constitutional provision wasn't enacted until over a year later because it had to be voted on by the people in order to have the constitutional amendment take effect.
Is there any evidence in the legislative history that the legislature intended anything different by the two provisions?
No. I have found no legislative history that would ever indicate that. These were passed within 3 weeks of each other using the same language.
Is there anything that a school district can do, well, would sex discrimination at some level by a school district as applied to students fall under the statute, be prohibited by the statute? Is there a line that can be drawn here, or should we just say sex discrimination as applies to high school students or junior high students is not covered by the statute?
No, that is not at all the position that I am arguing. My position before this court is that we have a very narrow category of hairway disputes before the court that is not appropriate. I'm not saying in other contexts that no sex discrimination statutes do not apply to school districts or the ERA doesn't apply to school districts. I'm not making that decision. This is very narrow holding, simply following the court's decision in Barber that is my position.
So you don't argue that the district could pass a rule that said female students couldn't take math courses because they don't need to clutter up their minds or that sort of thing?
No, I would not argue
this
that.
You're arguing about the dress code.
Exactly. It's a very narrow area, which the Fifth Circuit, obviously, this court relied on the Fifth Circuit's guidelines and established a bright line rule that, yeah, hair codes are permissible when you're talking about the elementary, secondary educational setting. However, they're not permissible in the college setting.
Let's suppose that the justice of this court thought this statute, by its terms, applied to a governmental decision in a school district involving hair, like if there was a difference between sexes or races. I know you disagree with that, but just suppose a judge were to think that. How would you suggest that a court should go about deciding what level of scrutiny to apply to any classification that a school district may?
Well, I think the lower courts are going to have to realize, indeed, this is a narrow holding simply dealing with hair length disputes. Indeed, the federal courts have had no problems in differentiating between the hair length cases that are not heard in federal courts as opposed to other claims against school districts. I mean, certainly a court by analogy could say, well, if a boy wants to wear a dress to school, the court and the school officials say, no, you should not be wearing a dress to school.
So
perhaps the court
the level of scrutiny that you say that the court should apply, if the statute applies, is a total exemption for hair length.
Yes.
There doesn't have to be any reasonable relationship, no rational relation. We don't have to put it through any of the normal equal protection tests that courts have devised.
That is the position for exempting or not intervening. But certainly at trial, if you want to move on to the second point of error, indeed the school certainly proved the rational, the compelling reasons for this hair length.
What was that?
We have five cases. For example, one of the reasons for the hair length rule was to teach the students to be able to function in society and realize that they're going to be encountering rules in the future. I mean, testimony is replete in this record that Zachariah Tungate, indeed, when he grew up, he wanted to join the Air Force and fly jet planes. I mean, don't you think it's an appropriate function of the school to teach the student at an early age that, Zach, if you want to join the Air Force, you know, you're going to have to cut your hair in order to do that. There's rules out there with which you have to comply.
Are women allowed to join the Air Force?
Certainly women are allowed to join the Air Force, but I do believe the Air Force has different rules for men and women as far as their hair length is concerned. But that's not the only basis for this rule that was proved at trial.
I'm sorry. It has been suggested that the statute declares certain conduct to be discriminatory that perhaps is not declared discriminatory by the Constitution. Can you think of a circumstance where the statute would apply declaring particular conduct to be discriminatory that the Constitution, where the Constitution would not have been implicated?
I cannot think of that kind of an example because, indeed, the Constitution affords the maximum protection against sex discrimination.
You just said, You said twice in answer to me that the legislature, despite our ruling in Barber, could pass a statute specific to this situation, which would not change the Constitution.
Yeah. I don't view that as being...
Now you're saying the opposite to Judge Enoch, and so I remain confused.
Okay. I'm just looking at the wording in the statute, and I'm just saying, is there anything in this statute that declares being conduct unconstitutional that would not implicate, that conduct would not implicate the Constitution? I understood your answer. You don't understand how this statute can, is any broader than what this, the Constitution is.
Exactly.
Now, I suppose if the statute said we declare any rules dealing with hair length to be discriminatory, then that would be a different situation.
Yes, it would.
Counsel, I'm on point error number two on some procedural matters. Would you explain to us what the jury found and on what basis the trial court set those findings aside and entered findings of fact contrary to what the jury found and rendered judgment on that basis?
I know that my light is on, but certainly in this case, we had a five-day trial. We had numerous school officials, child psychologists, everyone, numerous witnesses.
And the jury made findings in your favor.
The jury made findings of fact in our favor, nevertheless, and there was the evidence to support those jury findings in our favor on these statutory claims. Nevertheless, despite that, the trial court granted judgment notwithstanding the verdict, took away from the jury its role as a fact finder in this case, weighed the credibility of the testimony, took conflicting evidence and decided one way, completely improperly under the rules for when a court may grant judgment notwithstanding the verdict.
And made findings of fact inconsistent with what the jury found?
Absolutely.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Paul Knively will present argument for the respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Paul Knively. I'm here with Mr. Charles Bell, representing the respondent in this case, September Tungate, in her capacity as next friend of her minor son, Zachariah Tungate. I guess it should be obvious why I'm here, because hair is very important to me.
You're going to pass.
Get a rug.
I think I could get to school with a master up. Actually, I'm here because this case does present issues of law and fact, and issues of basic fairness and issues of equality under the law that really are very important. And they're particularly important to my clients in this case, the Tungate family, who chose to have their son have a little wispy ponytail when he was in the third grade. And the testimony in this case shows that he wanted to have a ponytail because his father had a ponytail. And that was the lifestyle and the style of hair dress that they chose. When he was in the second grade, it was not a problem, even though the pictures and evidence show that he had the same little ponytail in second grade throughout the school year.
Did they have that same policy then?
Yes, they did, Your Honor.
But did not enforce it?
Apparently did not enforce it, at least in any way that we're aware of. A few days into the school year, he was told that he could not have the ponytail. His parents were called, and he was sent home, suspended from school for a few days, and then they recalled him for in-school suspension, which, as the record showed and as the brief show, lasted for 4 months, in basically solitary confinement in a room by himself, where he was not allowed to go to recess with other children, not allowed to go to lunch with the other children, not allowed to participate in any of the other activities that the other children had, other than basic instruction that he received from high school educated substitute teachers in that room by himself.
Mr. Knightley, you make those claims, but the jury found all those facts against you.
The jury made specific findings, but they were based on initial determination by the jury in the first two questions that this was not sex discrimination. That was absolutely, completely, by all parties' admission, contrary to the reality and the evidence. And once they made the findings that this is not sex discrimination, the subsequent findings that it was not discrimination that imposed a burden, there was not discrimination that denied a benefit, it was not discrimination that denied participation in a program, make no sense.
Were those predicated findings?
Your Honor, I have to say, I don't recall, frankly. I don't know that they were.
Are you saying you proved those as a matter of law?
Yeah, Your Honor, I think the trial court, to answer the question that was asked a moment ago, disregarded the findings for two reasons. One, and the court made this clear to us throughout the trial, frankly, that he was concerned that on remand from the Court of Appeals, this was a legal and judicial issue, that the way the case was framed on the first appeal and remanded was a balancing test that the court was to apply based on balancing the interest of the individual to be free from gender discrimination and the interest of the school district in promoting its educational policies. The court said it here, it told us several times through the trial, I don't know that there's a jury issue here. I think I'm instructed to make this determination. And all of us said, well, let's submit the issues, at least if we have to appeal, or either side has to appeal, we want to go back and see if they weren't submitted. But the court also set aside the findings on the basis of that they were contrary to conclusive evidence in the case, that the school district did not demonstrate any compelling interest in enforcing this discrimination.
Well, let me ask you, if the answer to the first question submitted to the jury was that the policy, the hair policy, didn't violate the statute, then all the rest of the findings, evidentiary and not really relevant to that issue, which as I understand it, is the focus of this appeal.
Well, the first two issues together really said that the rule did not discriminate on the basis of sex.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, it makes no sense, frankly.
Well, I understand that, but the procedural and legal...
Yes, the subsequent questions all are based on, did it discriminate on the basis of sex in some way, denying, imposing an unreasonable burden, and so forth.
So, the first two questions are the key to the whole case.
As a practical matter, they really are.
Is your position then that it is a question of law that the court would be required to construe the statute, not just looking at what it said and deciding whether it was or wasn't, and all the rest of it is superfluous?
Well, again, I think there may be circumstances where some rule that has...
Is this case?
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's the point, is that this rule did not find, there was no justification that would allow this kind of intrusion into the denial of equal rights under the law.
Are you saying that these are legal questions or that these findings should be subjected to a no evidence review?
I think it's a little bit unclear. This court in Barber indicated there's mixed questions of fact and law in this area, at least as far as the constitutional issues are concerned. And I think in this circumstance, with respect to the statutory issues as well, because ultimately if the law of the case that was established in the first appeal is to apply at least, then there's a balancing test, which I think is almost by its definition a court's type of analysis to make, and that is you're balancing interest to make a legal determination.
But the Court of Appeals reversed the summary judgment in favor of the school district on the basis of a factual dispute, did they not?
And this is why the trial court had some difficulty, because it was sent back to do this balancing, and it said the court shall then make a determination whether this violates the Constitution.
What's your position on that balancing? Is this a balancing test, or does the statute prohibit discrimination, period?
Well, the statute prohibits discrimination, period. Obviously, there is no rule that can be applied absolutely to every circumstance. I think that there are circumstances where boys and girls can be treated differently.
For example,
separate restrooms.
Well, but could they have a dress code that boys can't wear dresses?
I think a challenge could be made that that's a denial of equal rights. It's certainly a discrimination on the basis of sex, but it does not, this is why the balancing test, I think, does enter into it. It does not intrude upon as fundamental an interest as requiring one to change one's body, in essence, by cutting hair.
A boy wants to wear a kilt because he's Scottish. Their ancestry is Scottish. But you say the school district arguably could not prohibit that.
I think one can argue that, but I think that's a different issue because really you're just telling the child, we have a certain dress requirement or attire requirement during the school day, but we're not going to affect the rest of your life. You want to wear your kilt when you're home, that's your choice. But with hair, you can't do that. You can't say, we're going to require you to have short hair at school and then go do what you want at home. When you're imposing on the person's physical bodily integrity with the rule, there's a greater intrusion on that person's rights. And that's why some balancing has to enter in. If, for instance, you talk about separate restrooms, there's a balancing interest in the privacy of the individual that rises to a level in and of itself that may justify a separate treatment.
Could they say that all students, boys and girls, could not have more than shoulder-length hair.
That would certainly not be a denial of equal rights on the basis of sex. There might be some other problem with it, but that would not be.
An intrusion, though, on a girl's wanting to wear her hair longer.
Sure, and this is really a concern that some of us had in response to the Barber decision, is that by abstaining from any intervention in these kinds of decisions, even on constitutional grounds, the court is really saying, even if there's a racially discriminatory rule, which, by the way, in this rule there is, afro hair shall not be longer than 3 inches, and the school superintendent admitted that only applied to African-American students.
But that's equal treatment if it's to all African-American students.
Well, that's like saying all African-Americans were allowed to sit on the back of the bus.
But you have to look at it as a class, don't you?
I'm sorry, Ron?
You have to look at it as the class. What's the protected class?
Well, the protected class is boys and girls. In this case, it's discrimination on the basis of sex.
Yeah, but your example of the African-American...
Well, yes, but in this very rule, the Bastrop rule that we set out in our brief, also has in it a rule that deals solely with the length of African-American students' hair. That kind of discrimination...
But it doesn't say, and boys will be this way and girls will be that
correct.
Way.
It's a different so classification than a racial classification.
To an entire class, what's the answer to that? Is it discriminatory if you treat the suspect class equally?
Yes, because it is the very existence of the suspect class that is the basis for the discrimination. If you say all boys must do this, or all boys shall not do this, or all girls must have hair shoulder length, or all girls must shave their legs, other things that interfere with the physical integrity of the person require a greater scrutiny, ultimately, than ones that are balanced by compelling interests such as privacy,
but,
which would justify separate treatment.
But focusing on the statute, as setting aside the constitutional issues, where is the touchstone, the legal touchstone, for putting an overlay of balancing of rational relations and all of that on a statute as opposed to a constitutional issue?
Well, in and of itself, the legislature, it seems to me, has the authority to make an absolute rule. Now, again, there may be some point at which you say the rule cannot be absolute to the ultimate degree because there are certain circumstances where there are competing, compelling interests. But at the very least, when the rule is made with the legislative authority on absolute terms, then there ought to be at least a compelling state interest demonstrated in order to overcome the prohibition against the discrimination.
The statute uses the word reasonableness in it.
With respect to unreasonable burden, particularly, yes.
Based on that language, we should require the district to show a compelling interest
it's hard to say you can have a compelling but unreasonable decision, but I think that you can say, at least with respect to this case, that requiring an 8-year-old boy to spend 4 months in isolation because he had a little wisp of hair below his collar is an unreasonable burden on the basis of the sex.
Are we making separate complaints? Do you have distinct claims on the basis of the initial rule itself and how the rule was applied with regard to the punishment imposed, as it were?
Yes, and that's really where that portion of the statute, I think, is most applicable is with respect to the punishment in this case. And that's why I think, again, this case factually is distinguishable from Barber, apart from the fact that it's a statutory claim in addition to the constitutional claim, is that this punishment was grossly excessive for this boy's conduct regardless. And that's what the unreasonable burden language, I think, addresses in this case.
Mr. Nicely, are you arguing that the jury has no role in interpreting this anti-discrimination statute as applied in an individual case?
Not necessarily. But again, I think if there were, in fact, evidence to show a compelling interest on the state, by the state, and that was taken into account by a jury, I think that it's possible.
Well, if a jury has a role in these decisions as they apply things like the Deceptive Trade Practices Act and other circumstances, the jury can certainly refuse to make a finding in favor of the plaintiff, can they not, on the basis that they are not persuaded?
Yes, but when...
And that doesn't require any evidence to support that no finding, does it?
No, but there can be conclusive evidence to the contrary, and that's what we say in this case.
Okay, I was trying to understand your argument. So you're saying you prove this as a matter of law?
In this case, under the instructions on remand the first time, that the trial court sets out in its opinion, I think it's on page 2 of its opinion, it's attached as an appendix to our brief, where it sets out, these are the instructions I was given by the appellate court, and this is the test I am following. If it's
a matter of law and the jury has no role under the facts of this case, why did the trial judge make findings of fact?
I think that the judge was basically giving an analysis for setting aside the jury verdict.
So we should give no weight to the findings of fact?
Well, again, if the court, as I understand it, was acting under instructions from the Court of Appeals to do this analysis, to do this balancing analysis, and here are the facts that I looked at to determine whether the school district has done what it must do to tip the balance in its favor, and it didn't do that. It didn't prove anything like that. It didn't prove any compelling interest. These rationales or rationalizations that it stated just simply are ephemeral. They don't have any substance to them when on scrutiny. It's one thing to say we have a rule because we have a rule and kids need to have rules, but that there's no substance to that. There's no evidence that can justify this discrimination in these circumstances. It hasn't been any shown. The evidence is conclusive to the contrary.
Mr. Nisley, can you think of any circumstance that would be a prohibited conduct under the statute based on differentiation of sex that would not be prohibited in the Constitution for discrimination on sex?
If the court's decision in Barber is, as I understand it to be, that the court simply does not believe that this kind of issue arises to a constitutional level, but the legislature has made a determination that it's unlawful, then that this issue itself, I think, fits in that category.
Well, my question really is, does the statute make discrimination of conduct or declare certain conduct to be discrimination based on sex that would not otherwise be discrimination based on sex under the Constitution?
I don't have an example in mind other than this case based on Barber's analysis of the Constitution.
Barber doesn't declare it not to be unconstitutional. It just declares that the courts won't be involved in it.
That's correct. That's correct. So, none comes to mind immediately. There may well be some.
Would you have acknowledged that there are certain circumstances, balancing tests, whatever, where discrimination based on sex is permissible? Segregated restrooms, as an example, I suppose.
It's certainly arguable that that's
dressing areas in gyms. I guess, as you say, arguable.
You know, separate sports teams, perhaps.
You said that at least it's arguable that that's permissible, but meaning that it's arguable that somebody could claim that separate restrooms are discrimination based on sex and prohibited.
And then when the trial court is asked to consider the evidence in that case, and the evidence is shown that there is an interest in the privacy of the individuals because of the very nature of the sexual distinction, that is a sufficiently compelling reason to allow an exception to an absolute statement of the rule.
From what you're saying, I gather you think that the Court of Appeals crafting a test did not put enough of a burden on the state to justify any classification too much. Because you keep using the word compelling.
Well, the test that this court declared in the McLean case 10 years ago was that sex...
Right to Constitution.
Yes, sir.
You're saying the constitutional test has to be imported to the statute.
Well, I think it should be in this instance, yes.
And so a Court of Appeals opinion, you think, is insufficient?
I'm not sure what Your Honor is getting at.
Well, this statute, despite its long history, has had very little judicial review.
Right.
I'll get to another case in a minute. But the Court of Appeals, in two opinions, has kind of crafted up a test.
Correct.
Do you think is that an adequate test or is it inadequate?
No, I think it's an adequate test. I think it's a possible test. I think it's a legitimate test. I think it's an adequate test because it allows for a certain degree of flexibility in the interpretation of these kinds of issues.
Well, I'm going to ask you about the Duke case. No, the Fifth Circuit looked at predecessor version of the statute some years back, and found it not to, found it to be not all encompassing, and that discrimination needed to fall within a particular category in order for the courts to take cognizance of it. What do you say about that case? It's one of only two cases we really have to look at.
Which case was that?
Duke versus UTEP.
I don't recall. That was the professor tenure case. I don't recall, frankly, what the test was that was applied in that case. I'm sorry, if you could repeat your question one more time, I'd take another shot.
Well, just look at Duke and send us
a
letter.
All right.
Is there indication in the legislative history that the amendment and statute were intended to have different meanings or applications?
I'm not aware of anything to that effect in the history itself. Again, I'd have to take another look to be sure, but I don't recall.
Is that one way or the other?
Right, correct. I don't recall that it addresses that one way or the other. But it does obviously have some very specific provisions, you know, about denying benefits, denying participation in the program, which really are well beyond what the Constitution states. I wanted to mention one thing. I think it was Justice Owen who asked earlier about other state case law. And I just happened to come across one that was not mentioned in the briefs, and I had forgotten I even had it until I went back through my materials, from West Virginia. It's State X. Rel. Lambert, Lambert, versus West Virginia State Board of Education, 447 Southeast 2nd 901, in West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals. I don't know if that's their Supreme Court or not, but in 1994, in which they held unconstitutional the scheduling of the girls' basketball team in a different part of the year than the boys' team was, and it had certain ramifications in terms of the quality of treatment and the quality of the facilities and so forth.
The legislature has given pretty broad powers to the school district to make rules and make rules of conduct. Shouldn't we read that part of the education code along with this in deciding how specifically to apply these very general rules? Very general prohibitions against discrimination.
I don't think it'd be inappropriate to consider that together, but to the same extent that the legislature grants broad authority to the school districts, it also has the authority to limit it. And when it limits it, it's by saying you shall not discriminate on the basis of sex, it's that certainly within their authority. I know my time is up. Justice Owen, I just wanted to refer, Your Honor, to footnote, I believe it was footnote 13 in that case. They said they decided on state equal protection constitutional grounds, but they also mentioned that there was a statute which would also cover that. It was a human rights statute, somewhat similar to the provisions in this one about benefits being equally afforded.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Your Honors, first I would like to clarify some of the portions of the record that were referred to by opposing counsel. First, did Zachariah have the same ponytail in second grade, where he says, oh, there was no disruption there because he had the same ponytail? Well, in the record, you will find the direct, positive, clear testimony of the second grade teacher. No, he did not. He had a ponytail, but it did not extend beyond the bottom of the collar. He was not in violation of the school rule in second grade. That's one of the things that the jury considered. The court, in its own fact findings, went the complete opposite direction.
Are we bound by these fact findings if there's any evidence to support them?
The jury findings. Yes, you are bound by the jury findings.
Despite our discussion in the workers' comp case about, and in Richard versus Mino about the difficulties of jury findings in constitutional balance.
But that's another point I want to make. This is not a constitutional balancing aspect of the statutory claim. The Court of Appeals, when it initially reversed the summary judgment the school district had obtained and sent the case back for trial, said, look, reasonable, we're talking about, was there an unreasonable burden imposed upon Zachariah? The court said reasonableness is inherently a fact issue for the finder of fact. Take it back to trial. We don't have sufficient evidence to establish this.
If the issue is whether a little ponytail is unreasonable, jurors are likely to differ pretty widely about that around the state, wouldn't they?
That's why this is an issue that is left up to the local school district.
You don't mind trying this case to a Bastrop jury, but you wouldn't want to try it to, say, a Houston jury.
Houston doesn't have to have this kind of a hair length rule. It's up to the local school boards to determine whether or not this is an educationally effective policy for their particular school district. And also, council was talking about, well, the differentiation between hair and dress. Justice Gamage, in his dissent in the Barber opinion, tried to make that same differentiation. The court did not find that type of differentiation in the Barber case. The jury in this case, in response to answers to jury questions numbers 3 and 4, specifically found, indeed, there was a compelling state interest, compelling interest for the school district's rules in this particular case. The jury found that indeed the school district proved its goals and objectives and its compelling educational reasons for this particular policy in answers to questions 3 and 4. In answers to questions 5 and 6, indeed the court said yes, Zachariah's long hair would materially affect and materially interfere with the school district's interest in this case. These are jury findings, and no, the court was not empowered when the evidence supported the findings to just disregard that and step into the role of the fact finder in this case. Also, let me talk briefly just about this unreasonable burden about the isolation of Zachariah. I mean, the court being led down the road that indeed if discipline in Bastrop was so lax that indeed there was 5, maybe 10 students who were in this in-school suspension with Zachariah, that would have been a reasonable thing, as opposed to, well, he was the only one at this particular time who was in this in-school suspension. Is that where this argument is being led?
Thank you. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will now take a brief recess.
All rise.